Hey, Ray, do you remember something in the Bible about the last days when the dead would rise from the grave?
I remember Revelation 7:12. And I looked as he opened the sixth seal, and behold, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became as black as sackcloth, and the moon became as blood.
The seas boiled and the skies fell.
Welcome to the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, continuation of their Ghostbusters retrospective series.
Everybody getting this so far?
Join Garrett.
I bet you like to read a lot too.
Matt.
You want a baby? Go ahead and knock up some willing hellhound.
And Adam.
What an asshole.
As they prove they're not afraid of no podcast and proceed with reviewing the series they started back in 2021.
You know, it's just occurred to me we really haven't had a completely successful test of this equipment.
I blame myself.
So do I.
Percolated media listeners, get ready for podcasting that makes you feel good.
Well, you can believe Mr. Pecker.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, Ghostbusters Retrospective, resumes now.
It's slime time.
Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. Released March 22nd, 2024. Budget was $100 million. Box office so far, $110.4 million. This was directed by Gil Keenan. Boys, you know, we have come upon a franchise. Well, we have gotten reacquainted with a franchise that is near and dear to me for a number of reasons. One, I think next to Star Wars, this really took up a lot of my room when I was a kid. I've explained this on past Ghostbusters shows, but for people who haven't listened to those, I was a massive Ghostbusters fan. I would play with those toys. I had a proton pack. I had the toys. I had the record album, which I put on my door and called the Ghostbusters Central. Like, I had so many things, and I reenacted this so many times. I was a huge Ghostbusters fan. That first movie means a lot to me. Go back and listen to the series that we did over at the other place. If you don't know exactly where that is, wait till after the show. We do say it in the final credits. But another reason it's near and dear to me, boys, is because this was the final full retrospective we did over at that other place. So here we are continuing it after Ghostbusters Afterlife did a good chunk of box office. Matt, here we are. We have another Ghostbusters film.
It's because of people like you that we're still keeping this thing going. As I said when we did the old retrospective back at the old place, and I reaffirmed this on our year-end show, I can't think of another movie that has failed to justify its existence as a franchise more so than Ghostbusters. It's been 40 years since that original movie, and it's still going, but not in any way that I would deem successful. I have not liked a single movie they have done after the first one, because the second one, I feel the way most people feel about it. Ghostbusters 2016, I don't feel is as bad as its reputation, but I still wouldn't quantify it as good. And then the last one, Afterlife, I was the most negative of the three because I felt like I was being shot with a proton bat in the face by nostalgia for 2 hours. So that leads me to this new movie, which I had no desire to see, and I have made that emphatically clear basically ever since this thing has been up on the radar. So I was not happy about revisiting this franchise whatso-fucking-ever.
Boy, we're going to have two angry people here, because the other person on this podcast I don't think has any desire to either. But here we go. So back at the other place, we brought Mr. Bunch on to help us with that review of Afterlife, because we had to continue it and we could not schedule it with the other person we were doing it with. So once again, Adam was brought along on that journey. And Adam, here you are, sir. We have once again seen a new Ghostbusters film and we are here to review it. How do you feel about having a new Ghostbusters film?
I feel like someone hit me with a proton pack and freaking trapped me into getting into this franchise. Much like, you know, he said, I think that first Ghostbusters film is something special. I think it's a timely thing, but to me that has a lot to go with Harold Ramis, and I really enjoy his type of films, his type of comedies, Stripes onward. So, I mean, even Ramis more than Reitman. So there, I hold a special affinity for that one. I can't stand Ghostbusters 2. For people to go back and be like, oh, it's not as bad as it. Yes, it is. It's worse than you remember. Go back and watch it. 2016, I think, is it's an attempt that falls horribly. And I think its insistence on acting like no Ghostbusters ever came before is its failure. Because I think that it had some good ideas, but I think the effects were shitty, and I think the story was even worse. In Ghostbusters Afterlife, I feel like if that was the only sequel I had to the first one, sweet. We finally got a second decent Ghostbusters property. For something that's 40 years old, before we talk about this one, we have Ghostbusters, and we have Ghostbusters Afterlife. Those are the only two watchable things. I'm not counting the cartoon. I mean, that's not a good record for something as beloved as this franchise appears to be for so many people.
It took the television series and a video game for this to get any return to decency, in my estimation.
And that video game is amazing. I'm going to reaffirm that.
You can do a lot of cool stuff with games with Ghostbusters. Oh, yeah. You really can.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it was perfect for a cartoon show.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
For sure.
Absolutely.
Like, this concept screams Saturday morning cartoon. And during that period, comparing it to stuff like Ninja Turtles, Transformers, it was by far the most inventive.
Yes.
With the success of things like Ninja Turtles recently animated, again, I mean, going back to TMNT, they've had a couple animated successes. With the Spider-Verse successes, with so many other things, animated Ghostbusters film, I'm kind of surprised wasn't somewhere in the works, because I think that would be pretty awesome. You could do some great stuff with that. But that's not what we got. Instead, we got a summer film that we released in March.
A summer movie is one of many instances of false advertising based on these trailers.
Oh, my God. Well, gearing up for this, unlike my other two colleagues, as I mentioned, I was a big fan of this series. So I did something that I used to do all the time, but I just don't have the time to do it anymore. I watched this entire series in the lead up to this film. Here's the reason why. I knew how I was going to feel about the first film. I knew how I was going to feel about the second film. First film, I feel, is almost perfect as far as off-the-cuff comedy, kind of lewd comedy, but disguised with this phantasmic plot. Everything about that movie still works to this day. The second film, I'm more on Matt's side, where I don't think it's as bad as its reputation. It's not nearly as good. It relies a lot on what happened previously, and they don't really do much new that works. But it's an enjoyable watch, and I was laughing quite a bit when I was watching it. And by the way, this was all in one day, too. It was one of my off days. I had edited those Stephen King shows. I was far ahead, and I was like, you know what? This is my second day off. The fiance is working all day. I'm just going to plop down here. I want to watch all four of these films in a row. I knew how I was going to feel about 2016 because it's another one where it isn't as bad as its reputation, but the more I watch that movie, the more I don't like it. The one I was concerned about was the predecessor to this one, because I feel like I watched that movie at a time where I was wearing rose-colored glasses, because it was the first date that me and Jen had had where someone on this podcast didn't accompany us. You recall, as Adam came with us to the first one, Halloween Kills, great first date. And that was the time when me and her were really getting to know each other, and it was just a really good time in my life. I was really, really happy at the end of 2021. And so I thought maybe the good feelings I had about it were due to that, and I hadn't watched it since. In rewatching it, I can safely say all of my good feelings about it have been reaffirmed. I think that movie works on so many levels. It gives me a lot of good feelings watching that movie, in that I think it was a loving tribute to the original. Yes, there were member berries, but it was also a love letter to Harold Ramis and basically the entire franchise. So coming to this one, I was still feeling pretty good. Me and Jen made a night of it. We went out to sushi before. She wanted to eat something slimy before we went and saw Slimer. That was her reasoning for wanting sushi before. So we went to this high-end sushi place, and then we went to this movie. We went all out. We went to the IMAX screening, and it was about half full, and people were really involved. We even saw somebody come in with full Ghostbusters gear on. This was opening night. So it was a pretty enthusiastic crowd. Matt, you saw this opening night too, correct?
Yes, and my crowd was enthusiastic, as you would expect. I went by myself because I knew I had to watch this, and I knew I had a limited amount of time to do so, and I didn't want to drag someone else for me to be miserable. Unless the movie surprised me, who knows. But the only one I rewatched was Afterlife, and I hate it even more now for this particular reason. And I think I said this on the Afterlife show, but I have to reaffirm it here. I feel like that movie is a, for something that wants to be a tribute to Harold Ramis, it's the direct antithesis of his type of comedy and the kind of films he made.
Yeah, that's the critique I've heard about it.
His movies made fun of being schmaltzy and sentimental, and they were purposely rebellious. And I'm just exhausted with nostalgia berries as it is. I think the first part of that movie is okay, when it feels like Jason Reitman was actually making an indie drama. You know, people in a small town, single mom.
Mm-hmm.
And then as soon as it cuts to that Walmart with those goddamn marshmallow men, they might as well have lit the celluloid on fire for me. Because I think the last 30 minutes of that movie is borderline unwatchable, and I would say insulting.
Wow. Adam, do any rewatches before this, or you just went in cold, cold, cold?
In it, and it's just I didn't have time, and I didn't really have the desire. It seemed like Ghostbusters was playing on TV frequently the last, like, 2 months or so, and Ghostbusters 2016 is what was playing on TV
the
last 2 months or so. I was like, man. So it kind of saps the energy out of me wanting to do it. But I've seen the original so many times that I could recite that movie credit to credit, you know, by heart. The second one, I said my piece about that film, and yes, I know I'm the pink slime underneath New York City. I don't give a shit. But Afterlife,
no, I'm with you. I Garrett put words in my mouth. I would rather watch 2016 than Ghostbusters 2. I don't think either of them are good, but I will give 2016 a certain amount of credit for the parts that made me laugh genuinely made me laugh. But that movie's biggest problem is that it desperately needed an editor, and Paul Feig, all he relies on for a lot of his movies is improvisation, and he doesn't know when to tell people to pull back.
And then when it came to Afterlife, I'd seen it a few times since, so I didn't feel the need to rewatch it. And I was busy in the weeks before I got a chance to go see this, so I didn't feel it necessary. I remembered, well, a little less, because there were some characters that I had to get refreshers on for this film. But I was ready to go, other than I didn't have a desire. If it wasn't for this, I wouldn't have seen it in the movie theater. The trailers did nothing for me, and I didn't understand the why. I felt you could have capped it with the last one and been okay. But surprisingly, my whole family wanted to go. So Easter Sunday morning,
wow,
we got up, went to the theater, 11:30 in the morning, after we had a nice Easter breakfast, and five of us, actually, because we brought my sister-in-law as well, all sat down to watch Ghostbusters, Elsa Return, Frozen Ever After, whatever this thing is.
I'm calling it that because they just can't let Ghostbusters go.
And I think I was the least excited, but it did make me feel kind of good that my kids were at least like, yeah, I want to go see more Ghostbusters. So maybe this isn't for me, and maybe what they did with Afterlife was get a new generation excited. And I don't think I realize that.
And I have to be upfront with this, too. The marketing for this movie was abysmal.
It was terrible.
Those trailers were
bad.
Really flat.
Mm-hmm.
It looked like what little bit of charm Afterlife had was sucked away because you hired the director of the Poltergeist remake to come and do this, which also did not do any sort of favoritism on my part to put me in this film's good graces. And everything I was seeing from, I thought the conceit was cool. I'm like, okay, that feels like out of the cartoon that they're living in, like, this new ice age. But everything from the new characters to the obvious callbacks, this movie did not put me in its good graces at all.
One more thing about the lead up to this. You know, it's funny. Previous to the job I have now, I was working at a resort, and Ray Parker would come to that resort quite frequently and gamble a lot. Even during my shift, I worked the graveyard shift, and he would come in and really, really, really nice guy. A little bit of a cheap tipper. But you could tell, I mean, the guy still gets residuals from that because he was gambling a lot. He's not living bad and a super, super nice guy. In the week before this, I was like, you know what? I want to do something I have never, ever done. Not in years. I took Ghostbusters, the song, and I made it my ringtone for like 2 weeks in the lead up to this film. Like, that's how much I was excited for this movie. Okay, so this movie, it started getting developed right when Afterlife came out and did pretty well. And supposedly, if you look at interviews with Gil Keenan, he says that Ivan Reitman, who passed away in February 2022, he did look at concepts that Gil Keenan and Jason Reitman had for this, and he approved of them before they rolled and before he passed away. So supposedly Ivan, that's why he gets a producer credit on this. Also, according to Gil Keenan, it was not that hard to get the original Ghostbusters back for this.
Well, clearly not, because Dan Aykroyd and Ernie Hudson are tied to this property at the hip.
Yeah, oh yeah. Hudson goes to every single con.
And Aykroyd is big into the paranormal, mm-hmm, and cult, huge. So I get why he would come back to this. Why did Jason Reitman not direct this?
That was the weird thing. I couldn't really find anything on that. I do know this was delayed due to the actor's strike. That was why it was released late. But as far as why Gil Keenan took the director's chair, I am not sure, unless it was kind of the emotional thing of maybe he didn't want to do it after his dad passed away. I couldn't really find anything on that. But I was thinking about that too, and my God, it could have used his touch.
Yeah, because it's not like he has something going on. You know, it's not.
Well, Jason Reitman has a lot of things going on. He's
Well, I mean, yeah, as a director, like he's always writing, he's producing, like he's a busy Hollywood guy, but he didn't have directing gigs lined up.
Yeah.
That would take him out of this one. But yeah, I do think your point is he made his love letter to his dad and then he lost his dad, you know, a year and a half later. I think I'm not surprised for him to put the keys down.
Can I let someone else?
In fact, about Jason Reitman, for those of you who don't know, him and Edgar Wright have a very strong resemblance to one another.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Big time.
And have never been in the same room at the same time.
And Aykroyd is so enthusiastic about this. He said just recently in an interview that he liked to have three sequels to kind of close everything out to this. So
he's been drinking too much of his own Crystal Head vodka.
He probably is. But it's got to be weird, though, if you're Dan Aykroyd and you're seeing your baby just kind of be taken by the son of the guy who directed the original. I get it. It's still within the quote-unquote family. But Matt, don't you think that'd be a little weird to see? Because Dan Aykroyd's in this. He doesn't really have a hand in this script. How do you think that went?
Dan Aykroyd, he picks his scripts by dartboard. Everything he's built his career on, he's come back to. I mean, this is the guy who said yes to Blues Brothers 2000.
Yeah.
So I don't think he's one to scoff at, oh, I'm not coming back to that. But at the same time, I don't think Ivan Reitman is the reason why Ghostbusters works. It's, if you ask people why they love Ghostbusters, they're not going to tell you it's because of the story. At least I don't think. It's those three guys, very distinctive comedic styles, playing off each other under the guise of a absurd plot. Which is why I don't think anyone has been able to replicate Ghostbusters. It is the, we say lightning in a bottle a lot, I don't think there's a bigger instance of that than that first Ghostbusters movie. I mean, because even Ivan Reitman with Evolution couldn't replicate it. And he tried. They tried desperately with Ghostbusters 2. So I think Aykroyd would have come back to this regardless, because I think this, he's a big part of why the first movie works, as is Bill Murray, as was Harold Ramis, and to no degree really Ernie Hudson. I'm sorry. You could have had anybody play Winston, and the movie would still function.
Well, if you had Eddie Murphy there, it'd be a completely different movie, which is what they wanted.
Oh, absolutely. As it would have been different if it was John Belushi instead of Bill Murray.
Yes.
Who was the one person, by the way, who I am shocked he came back for that.
You know what, though? According to Keenan, like, and even McKenna Gray said that he was like a super cool dude on the set. He was wanting to come back to this. It's just.
Yeah, he always is when there's 20-year-old females on set.
Oh, for fuck's sake. Everybody was enthusiastic coming back to this. So I feel like this was made with intentions of paying tribute to the producer and writer's dad. To talk about that, though, I think RoboCop would probably fit that bill, too. And I know it's different because Verhoeven never came back for any of those, but I think they tried with that second one to kind of replicate that feeling, and you just can't do it. And so they took it in as many different directions as they could until they did a remake 10 years ago that fell on its face. That's the only one that...
You know, it's funny, you have an argument, but the funny thing is, we'll have to redo RoboCop at some point, the three of us, because I feel differently about RoboCop 2 than I used to, and I actually think, and I said this at the time, I actually think the remake has more in its mind than people were given it credit for. It's still not great by any means, but I think Ghostbusters has a more of a disappointment for me versus RoboCop, also because the dip from Ghostbusters to Ghostbusters 2 I think is steeper than RoboCop to RoboCop 2. But yeah, you're right. Like, a lot of the 80s is... It was such a different time.
Yeah.
It's also a lot harder to... I think it's also harder to replicate comedies.
Oh, for sure. We start off with the Sony and Columbia logos. 100th anniversary of 100-year anniversary of Columbia, by the way. Crazy to see that.
And Sony should have this side logo that says, yes, we are still milking Spider-Man like a cancer cow. And there's nothing you can do to stop us.
Hey, you know what? I wasn't going to bring it up till later, but you mentioned the 100th anniversary. How do you not market this as Ghostbusters 40?
Yeah, I was thinking about that too.
This is
because you're so desperate to keep this property going.
It's the 40th anniversary, and that is nowhere in it. And it wasn't until halfway through this film when I went, wait a minute, That was 1984.
Mm-hmm.
You lost a huge opportunity, even to do it properly, which I don't know if they have it in them to properly market something like that with taste, but Jesus.
Well, yeah, Matt said it earlier. The marketing for this was horrible. Mm-hmm. Nothing about it. And I'm a Ghostbusters fan, obviously. Nothing about the trailers or anything leading up to this, even after liking Afterlife, did anything to make me want to see it.
Sony just doesn't... They don't have reverence for their properties. They look at them strictly as financial conglomerates, which is also hysterical considering how much money they lost on 2016.
Yep.
Because if you remember, there was going to be like a whole Ghost Corps sub-department.
There were plans. I was hearing word that there were major plans with that.
And honestly, like, look, I thought for sure with how multiverses are so popular, I thought for sure they were going to connect that and have a cameo by Kristen Wiig in this movie because of how popular this are, and how Sony is so preoccupied with studio groupthink.
They want to kick that so far to the back of the line that you'll never see that. You'll never get a reminder of that. Notice we have tributes to Ghostbusters 2 in this.
And also, like, if you're Melissa McCarthy, who's gone on since that movie to be, you know, Oscar-nominated actress, has her own production company, would you really come back to this after all the vitriol you went through?
So we then get... We get what seems to be a staple of this year's slate of shows, boys. We get a preamble on the screen to kick things off. Go ahead.
I crossed my leg at this point. I'm 30 seconds in and I already crossed my leg going, it's like they have a checklist of things designed to piss me off. And they're just going one box at a time.
There are so many of those in here. I can't wait to get to the end.
Because these movies don't care about the plots.
No.
Like, they are, like, so this is not the property to start with a wall of text.
Yeah, and it's a huge wall, too. I mean, this is fucking Ridley Scott shit going on right here.
Like, I sat there going, did Dan Aykroyd write this shit?
We go back to 1904, as we're seeing firemen come up to a freezing door and bust their way in. They see that all the people inside, as well as the room itself, is frozen. They touch a sphere, the frozen bodies explode, and we have witnessed the most underwhelming opening scene in any Ghostbusters film ever.
I thought it was fine, but how little did I know that the Frozen Empire would only really be for the last 20 minutes of this movie?
Oh my God, I have things to say. Yes.
Because I was shocked at the blatant false advertising that this trailer leads you to believe. Because this movie does not take place in an ice age for its entirety. It is... It's like they had the title, but didn't want to commit the full budgetary assets necessary to commit to it for the entire movie.
I just figured that what this meant was this was going to be turned into the fire department, the fire station later, and it was going to be like a 100-year culmination or whatever it would be, or that it happened over and over. Other than just introducing the orb from Guardians of the Galaxy, there's not really any other major thing that this, because this doesn't play into stuff later on other than, hey, it's cold, Elsa's pissed off, and she's trapped in the orb.
Yeah, is this the first one to actively use a MacGuffin as a plot device?
Yeah, I would think so, unless you consider the evil slime, which I don't, because I don't want to think about that movie anymore, but yeah, I think so.
Yeah, because the slime is more like a manifestation of the plot.
Yeah.
But this is like, I hate this type of story where we have to... It's also not consistent for the record, because as we find out, ghosts, despite being told they're connected to these objects, doesn't ring true for everybody.
How do we feel about this story going back to New York?
I'm a New Yorker by blood, so yeah. I always endorse it. But it's also the thing of, okay, how do we further connect this to the original? Well, we set it back where it all began. Because Afterlife, that was part of the charm of when it started, was this, you know, middle of Oklahoma, desolate. You know, it was a very different setting than the previous movies, because I think 2016 takes place in New York, too.
Yeah, it did.
So I'd like that Afterlife at least had that as an outlier, only for this movie to immediately go, nope, we're going back to New York.
Adam, you like being back in New York here?
I do. I think part of the Ghostbusters charm is seeing the firehouse, seeing Ecto-1 through the streets of New York City, though... This seems like it was filmed in the height of freaking COVID since there's no traffic in New York City. but I do think there's something about this that I think, and I liked Afterlife exploring, you know, a different area, but it still tied back. I think it was, I didn't have the issues with Gozer, you know, and what it meant other than a few little parts. But I do think that if you're going to do this, take it back to New York, especially if you're going to tie it back in with all the originals.
Yep. We cut to the Ghostbusters we ended the last film on, as Phoebe is still telling jokes and Trevor is bitching about not being paid for what he does. They're chasing a ghost called the Hell's Kitchen Sewer Dragon through the city. And you know what? I quite enjoyed this scene. I like Paul Rudd giving quips like, okay, that was cool, as Phoebe makes her way outside the car. I like the narrow misses as Phoebe gets back in the car. And I like the remote control car, and we introduced the drone here, the drone trap. We get a couple different traps. I found this opening scene to be fun stuff.
I thought it was cool. Thought it was a nice way to start. I thought it, you know, after the prologue, it puts you right back in the mindset of where these people are. You get a little bit of exposition. And though I'm going to say, if you have a flying dragon, don't use the remote control car. Just start with the drone. I understand it's a piece to show the new toy, but go with the drone for the flying dragon. I thought it was kind of cool. Whenever I hear Hell's Kitchen, I'm always going to have a Daredevil pop.
Oh, shit.
That's just automatic. But it, you know, I thought it was kind of cool. The dragon felt a little like the 2016 effects, though, and I didn't like those at all. But I did think it was kind of cool. I thought it was a different look for a ghost. And to have something like a dragon, it's amazing that this thing doesn't look like any type of spirit we get later on. I think you could have done something cool with mythical ghosts, but yeah, it's neat.
As far as being a fun action sequence, it gets the job done. But this movie establishes a big problem I have, and I hate giving it a backhanded compliment. There's too many main characters.
Oh my God, way too many.
Carrie Coon, once again, has nothing to do for most of this movie.
Nope.
Paul Rudd is 90s sitcom dad, much like he kind of is in the first one. And Finn Wolfhard is just here because they have him under contract and they cast him when Stranger Things was still popular. The only one that gets stuff to do is Phoebe, much like the last movie, but I'll save my thoughts on her for a little bit.
Yeah, I was going to say, please save that, because I have things
to say. But my question is, why did Podcast Kid move with them? Does he not have a family?
Hey, he's got a gig. Why would he go back to his family? No, I don't. They never give any reason. They just... And that's the one who aged the most, by the way, out of everybody. Like, I didn't even recognize him at first.
Oh, I had to do a double take. I'm like, are these the same kids?
Yeah. I thought they recast.
Yeah, this is that problem when you're shooting stuff during COVID. Kids age quick as it is.
Exactly.
They didn't luck out like the Harry Potter kids did, where they kind of aged appropriately, all things considered. This one's a big jump. And, yeah, the one who aged the most is Paul Rudd to Adam's point. I think I'm just done with Paul Rudd's shtick. He's got one mode, and that's all he can play.
He's played the same character ever since Clueless. I mean, he doesn't have range, and I get that people love him, and he's the aw shucks. To your point, the 90s dad is perfect. You might as well cast him in a remake of My Two Dads, but it's the same fucking thing every time.
We get a montage of news footage talking about how much damage the Ghostbusters have done, which hasn't been matched since the Ghostbusters tore up New York City with the Statue of Liberty. A little tribute to...
That part included in this film made me laugh harder than anything in Ghostbusters 2.
I like the recalls of Ghostbusters toys. Like, I had all these toys as a kid. But what's not fun is we then get caught up with Walter Peck, who apparently is the mayor of the city. Mayor of New York now. But Jesus Christ, he doesn't seem to... He's aged... about as much as Paul Rudd since 1984. I don't know. How do we feel about seeing Walter Peck here?
Groaned, because I'm like, okay, this is... They're going out of their way to leave no stone unturned. Not just the fact that they brought him back, but he's the mayor, because you need the mayor scene in every Ghostbusters movie.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so done with member berries as it is. And this was just yet another instance of them trying to do that. And he says there were no eyewitnesses of the previous movies, which is, I call, direct bullshit on.
He's calling the proton packs laser guns, as Gruberson defends his relationship with Phoebe by calling himself her step-teacher. Peck ends the conversation by saying he won't stop until the firehouse they're in is a pile of bricks. Speaking of the firehouse, I was reading interviews with Keenan and Reitman leading up to this, and they made it a point in their script to make sure we get a better look at what goes on in the firehouse in this film. Because we go in the kitchen, we're seeing the gang cooking up some food. This was important for them. But did we really need to see all this domesticated stuff? I didn't.
For a film that is, I think we're all going to agree by the end of this, for a film that seems to have had a problem finding an editor to chop it down. There's a lot of scenes that could have been cut. And some of these type of domestic scenes here in the firehouse is exactly how you could have trimmed 25 to 30 minutes out of this without sacrificing anything.
Yeah, I'm in agreement. This movie desperately needed, much like 2016, it desperately needed an editor, and it needed someone to say, okay, there's a fine line between callbacks and just being blatantly nostalgia bait. There is a key difference. And I feel, much like Afterlife, this movie's too much of the latter.
Phoebe wants to realize her calling and be a Ghostbuster, as we hear the entire last film recalled by Gruberson and Callie, with them turning into dogs and whatnot. Let's discuss these two in this movie. We're getting a little bit of a plot, with Callie trying to encourage Gruberson that if he wants to take the next step with her, he needs to stop being the fun uncle and mature into somebody who can be called a dad. But really, Matt, you mentioned this earlier, but I'm going to say it now. These two take a massive backseat to their kids in this movie, and I found Callie to just be a nag. Which I hate saying because I did really like her in the last one.
She's just there to be the nagging mother in this movie.
Terrible.
Because of what they write Phoebe to do.
Mm-hmm.
But also, for a movie that seems more hellbent on focusing on the kids more, I would have just removed the parents entirely.
Exactly.
Like, really focus on the kids. I'm not saying make this the Goonies, but, you know, try something similar along those lines. This one's much more kidified than any of the previous ones. So I don't understand why they didn't just take that angle to its fullest extent.
I don't mind them. I get way too much Paul Rudd, but I crush on Carrie Coon throughout the course of the film.
God's
so
sake.
It is what it is. I know. Get over it. But at that point, if you want to take them out, it'd be really easy to do. Send them on their honeymoon.
Yeah, there you go. Perfect.
You know, you could have them cameo in it so that they're gone and maybe their ship can't come back because the harbor's frozen over. Damn it, I just wrote a better film. I mean, you got ways that you could do it.
Yeah, or they're still trying to sell the house back in Oklahoma.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's a good one, too. And, yeah, because if it was the whole point of this is for him to prove that he's worthy of being married to. So I think Matt's point is actually better taken. I think you could have had them try to sell that house because, again, they play nothing into this.
Yeah.
Sell the house, isolate off Manhattan, isolate the island off like it's Escape from New York by freezing over, you know, the water.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to go this extent, because the last movie basically made Phoebe to be a super genius, do the Sheldon Cooper thing where she's a middle school kid going to Columbia University. And Trevor goes with her to be like her, you know, legal counsel or whatever.
Gruberson puts the trap away and the containment unit starts shaking before the light turns green, meaning the trap is clean. But this can't be good the way it's shaking here. We then cut to Ray Stantz talking on a show called Repossessed, where an old lady brings in a watch for Stantz to take a look at. Wasn't this a shit Venkman was doing in the second film?
Yeah, like he was doing like public access.
Yes.
I feel like it's exactly what he's doing on the History Channel right now.
Oh, yeah. We see Podcast, who, as I mentioned, of all the kids that return, he's the one who's most noticeably gotten older. And then we see the return of the Stay Puft Gremlins.
Oh, you mean the Minions?
Yes.
I hated everything with these little bastards.
I know. I thought we got enough of them in the last one.
They're not ghosts. Why the fuck are they here?
I know. Just to have the references to Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. We then see the entry of another new character. This one played by Kumail Nanjiani, right? That's how you say that.
Nanjiani.
He has a wonderful podcast about the X-Files. He did it about 10 years ago. It's really good. He's a huge X-Files fan. I find him to be really funny. He was in a good movie with Dave Bautista, I believe. That was really entertaining.
Oh, Stuber?
Yes. Oh, my God. Funny fucking movie. He's hilarious in it. But in this, I find him to be... In the beginning, I find him to be really annoying. He gets better as the movie goes, but I don't like his character.
I'm the opposite. He's the only person in this movie who genuinely made me laugh.
Wow.
But also, it's because of a new character who I actually like, which I usually don't get in these Ghostbusters movies.
All right, Adam, break the tie.
I don't mind him. But if I'm going to have Nadim, I don't want Podcast. I don't want Lucky. I don't want the other people working for Ernie Hudson's character. Like, I don't want everybody else to show back up if you're going to introduce other characters. So I think this guy's going to matter, but he's in here and then he disappears till, you know, kind of the third act starts to show up and, hey, okay.
Yeah, he comes back when the plot is convenient for him to return.
Yeah.
But I do think to make him... You know, the Fire Master at a time where we're getting Avatar seems a little race baiting on their point.
You're not wrong, because all we needed was a bald-headed Asian kid, and we would have had all four elements in this movie.
I mean, it's in your face.
Nadim gives Ray the globe that we saw at the beginning of the film as Ray's dumbass lets loose of some kinetic energy from the containment unit. We then see the return of Janine as Trevor notices something in the article, and before taking care of it like an adult, he goes to his mommy for consultation. One thing I wanted to say about this movie, and boys, we talked about this, I want to bring it up. It's one of quite a few problems I have with it, but it's probably my biggest problem. After this Nadim scene, I kept waiting for something to happen. And this film never really feels like it gets going until its final third. And boy, do I have things to say once we get there. But Matt, don't you feel like this kind of drags a bit?
Oh, I feel like this movie is doing the ultimate like mystery box ploy, where you're spending the entirety waiting for something to happen and escalate. And when it finally happens, the movie only has 20 minutes of runtime left.
Mm.
So it feels really rushed. And so much of this movie, I'm just bored. I don't find a lot of comedy to hit. Because remember, this is a Ghostbusters movie, so it should be funny. It's really not. It's weird how, like, it's plotting, but I'm also largely bored.
I get your point, but there's some stuff that happens here in the middle that I actually really like, and I'll let you get to that. But I do agree that I'm just like, okay, can we move this? Can we get to what the story is supposed to be about? Can we get to what the story teased us for in marketing and what it set us up for at the beginning? Because we don't get back there for a really, really long time.
Trevor heads up and follows the noises he hears to a pile of garbage. And is there any mystery as to who's here?
Yeah, I thought the hemorrhoid come in. as dreading this. I mean, first of all, the marketing spoils it.
Yep.
But also, there's no surprise. Like, if you were going to do this, why even bother creating the Muncher character in the previous movie? We're just going to go back to this bullshit.
I don't have a big problem with this, and I'll tell you why. Because he comes back at the end, at the climax of the movie. If it was just for this set of scenes, I'd be really railing against it. But if he becomes a part of the plot, so I'm not too angry about it.
No, I'm not either. I mean, you must have gotten a threat from Bill Murray that you were not allowed to call this the real Ghostbusters. Because he would have been insulted, because this is right out of the cartoon.
Yeah.
Where Slimer took up residence, you know, up in the attic of the firehouse. It's okay, it's cute, but yeah, to Matt's point, like, I hated that Muncher character in the last film, and they did it just to not do Slimer, and instead, all they did was bring back Slimer. So, I'd rather have this, you know, big green guy, you know, as a part of my childhood. I'm really glad that Wolfhard did not do the "he slimed me," because I thought he was going to say it, and I can't believe there's restraint in this film. But I'm at least pleased that they minimized it. We get it here, and then he doesn't show back up till the end. Because they could have had him riding freaking on the top of the Ecto-1 for all that they could have done.
I feel like these Slimer scenes are the only reason Finn Wolfhard's here. These are the only things he really has to do for this entire film.
To Matt's point, he's here because he's on contract.
Yeah.
Because this way, Universal can have a Ghostbusters and a Stranger Things Horror Nights House this year.
I would not have included Slimer at all, but I'm also the only person who is done with the callbacks. Like, I've been done with this crap, so anytime I see it, I just have an aversion to it.
We cut to Phoebe playing chess in the park, and just like the last film, she's playing chess with a spirit, but this time it's not Egon, but some Gina Davis, Jenna Ortega concoction called Emily Lind. We learned that her character died in a fire, which is why she's half on fire, and we're seeing this relationship develop as the ghost asks her to help her complete unfinished business, and it's at this point that I realize I'm in the plot of 1995's Casper, also starring Aykroyd, by the way.
Yeah, as a Ghostbuster, which yep. is the funny thing. There's no surprises with this plot line whatsoever. And I hate that we have resorted this character to being the rebellious, bratty teenager, because that's the only plot point they have. And they focus way too much time on it, and it makes me turn on this character completely, who is the one person I liked in the last one.
You took the words right out of my mouth, because I have those written down here. I really liked Phoebe. Now they've turned her, like you said, into a lovesick teenager. It is so fucking stupid. I fucking hate this character so much, and that pains me to say, because I enjoy McKenna Grace and I enjoyed this character so much last time, and this film I fucking hate her.
I also hate how they dance around the obvious lesbian
of course overtones. Yeah, they're not gonna come out and say
just commit to it, for God's sake. No one's gonna care.
I liked her a lot in the last film, and I enjoy her in this one.
Really?
I Jesus, one of the only characters I actually care about in this film that I enjoy watching. I think she does a good job. I like the scene in the park with the chess. It's clear that I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe they're going to bring him back from the dead a second time. And I appreciate, and they tease us with it. Like, of course, we're supposed to believe that her dad or grandpa's going to come back. You know, they're going to bring Ramus back again. I'm glad they don't. To Matt's point, is there any surprise that the girl on fire is going to help save the day against the ice monster? No. No, there isn't. You know, but I got my daughter right next to me looking just like McKenna Grace does when she's on screen. You know, we're both like, she's gay, right? Oh, yeah. You know, so
even kids are picking up on it.
Oh, yeah, there's no surprise that these two are crushing on each other, you know, in this film.
This is this is also from Goosebumps. This is the ghost next door. Because the twist in that book is that the ghost died in a house fire.
Well, shoot, halfway through it becomes Let the Right One In.
Oh, yeah.
I find it sweet between these two. I don't like the way that they use her later on with something, but yeah, it's weird because it's almost like it's a different kind of movie than Watt, you know, or the big villain at the end of it. So it's almost two different things going on. But I like these two when they're sharing the screen. And it's not the first time we've seen her because she was Snakebite Andy that we discussed in Dr. Sleep.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that.
Yep.
Well, then again, I spent more than half this film thinking this was Jenna Ortega. The Beetlejuice preview played before this movie. So I looked at Jen. Halfway through the movie, I'm like, Jen, boy, Jenna Ortega is really busy this year, isn't she? She looks at me and goes, honey, that's not Jenna Ortega. I'm like, oh. So when Phoebe asks the ghost what her favorite part of being a ghost is, the ghost replies, this, and then she disappears.
So that's what that feels like.
We then learn that there are many things in the containment system trying to get out, and this is when we get reacquainted with Winston, played by more than gamer Ernie Hudson. Question, how do we feel about Winston pretty much being the most successful out of the Ghostbusters? So successful that he's actually funding this whole thing.
I think that's actually a clever commentary, considering he's the fourth wheel in the first one. He's the guy who says, if there's a steady paycheck, I'll believe anything you say. Mm-hmm. And of course, he's the one that turns out to be the big philanthropist. And of everybody, he's the one who's most enthusiastic to be here, and I think he's got a welcome presence about him, so I liked Ernie Hudson in this a lot. And speaking of people who don't age,
yeah,
he's the same age as Trump, and he looks 30 years younger.
Yeah, it's surprising how well he comes back into this role and kind of fits the movie that they're telling. But I like what they do with him quite a bit. I think the meta knowledge just lets us have a little fun with it with Ernie Hudson. But yeah, I mean, it's a good spot, and I like that at least somebody. You know, Venkman did his thing, and Ray's doing his thing. So to have one guy just be successful at it all, I think is a good way to go.
I saw him at a con probably about 9 years ago. Yeah, he loves talking about Ghostbusters, man. He was not really enthusiastic about the remake about the 2016 movie they had coming out the next year. But, man, I mean, you get him talking about Ghostbusters, he won't stop. I would really like to see him at another con to hear what he has to say about the new crow, but that's for a new discussion for another.
Oh, he already said his thoughts on it.
We learned that the containment system is running out of space, but there was a burst of spiritual energy from 1984 that opened a pathway to the other side that we saw when Gozer got out in that first film. And the fireplace is the quote-unquote finger in the dam, and they have to protect it. So this is when we're introduced to a new containment system. Actually, it's the Paranormal Research Center. Boy, this is convenient.
This is a weird conceit. I got a hard time going with this, that he would have been setting this up the whole time, and then it's like, oh, how long is it going to take? Oh, this is going to take years. Well, maybe you should have been doing it little by little. Maybe you could have built the building next door or use abandoned subways. I think you could have done something cool with it, especially because of the slime in the subways, you know, from 2. You could have been like, hey, we turned this entire subway system into a containment unit, but this is a weird conceit just to get these two annoying sons of bitches back in this film.
We then see Trevor meet up with Lucky, who's back. I wasn't, when she came back, I was like, oh yeah, I remember her from the last film.
I remembered her about an hour later, because I was like, why are we bringing in more new characters?
I pressed the panic button because I was having Madam Web PTSD when she showed up again.
We see a grandfather clock that is inhabited by an actual grandfather, which I thought was kind of clever, actually.
A cute joke.
Yeah. And we have a second chamber where ghosts can be properly disposed of. And, of course, a new containment unit.
Cycling.
And, of course, a new containment unit, home of the strange, as they say. We hear that Podcast has been testing names for their new orb, including Blue Ball of Hate and Devil's Testicle.
And then we see a little yellow ghost that slimes the glass, and we meet the possessor. Gee, I wonder if this thing gets out. Phoebe fixes Gruberson's proton pack as the Ghostbusters bell rings. Phoebe answers the phone and hears that someone has a ghost and they need help right away. Moore attempts to extract what's in the globe happen as the globe fights extraction and everything shuts down. Keenan is doing a nice job of setting up a threat as red lights are turned on and scary images are flashing by. But the direction of this just, it doesn't feel like it has any really even flow to it.
No, and it's never genuinely scary, even in a Ghostbusters context. Because, like, the first one has some hardcore shit in it.
Considered,
like, fucking Sigourney Weaver getting dragged into the... Yeah. You know, there's stuff in that works really well for outright comedy. This movie has none of that. And quite frankly, it's a tonal mess.
It really is.
A lot of it's really flat, and I feel like this is, of the five movies, this one, even more so than 2016, feels the most disjointed, and that's saying a lot.
Basically, I think it's a little all over the place. Like, it doesn't have a consistent flow to it. The scene's cut, and then the scene afterwards just go in a different way, a different tone, and with different characters that almost don't even interact, except when they meet up at the end. So it's like this containment unit, you know, you're using it to pull out ghosts to put them in the big unit, but yet you're keeping some in like a closet just because.
Yeah,
it's not all the way thought out, you know. It's like, hey, this is going to look cool on screen. It's just basic contrivance, and it, you know, to Matt's point, the horrors aren't there, the scares aren't there, and Ghostbusters wasn't a horror film, but you had those elements. And you know what they should have done? Kill one of these kids.
Ooh.
Either
that's a little drastic.
Yeah, that's way drastic.
No, but I mean, either kill Lucky or kill Lars. Lars is supposed to be at least like 20, right?
Yeah.
Kill that freaking annoying some bitch. Shove that microphone back in his head.
Wow.
Like something to make you feel there's a threat. Because I just never feel any danger from anybody.
It doesn't help that the danger doesn't even come in until 20 minutes are left. You know? Meanwhile, Phoebe and Podcast, they show up at the diner that called about the ghost that they've been ordered to bust, and we see that it's actually the one Phoebe was talking to earlier.
And we see that's where she gets her name. It's Melodies.
Yep. The ghost comes over, and Phoebe invites her in, and then she stupidly just shows her around the entire facility, again, just reducing this fucking character to a dumbass. Eventually, she's going to be the cause of everything. She goes to the containment facility, and they're both talking about the bonds that break when someone crosses to the other side. And Melody says that she wants to eventually join her family on the other side as she lights a match. Callie comes down, and then Melody disappears. We then get some visuals of the city as the containment unit struggles to hold everything in.
This containment unit, because it's introduced at the beginning. Why do we keep going back to the exact same problem? Hey, the containment center's full, we're going to release the ghosts. The containment center's full, we're going to release the ghosts. I mean, really? Over and over and over again. And you don't do it any better. I mean, you might as well have put Peck in a freaking EPA outfit instead of making him mayor. Have him date Bonnie Bedia if you want the callback so bad.
Meanwhile, Trevor is still leading the Slimer pursuit. I thought all of this was actually rather fun, all this Slimer stuff.
We chuckle. Like, it's minimal. So... It could have been really annoying. I could have felt like Matt if I was pissed off about the member berries part of it, but I'm glad it's minimal, and God knows Wolfhard has nothing else to do in this movie.
Exactly. They go to Nadim's apartment as he slams the door in their face, but then he just lets them in and shows them paintings in his house, and then takes them down into a hall of secrets. Phoebe then asks Ray if he ever wonders what it'd be like to be a ghost, and Ray says every day of his life. And for some reason, I felt this was fucking Dan Aykroyd talking. This was not Ray the character. This was Dan Aykroyd. If you know...
I thought we were going to have a legitimate suicide discussion by the end of this film.
Yeah.
And I thought it was going to have to do with her, you know, missing Grandpa Spangler.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought that was going to come up too, actually. They then grab Ecto-C, which apparently is a moped.
Ecto-Cooler reference.
Yeah. Good catch, Adam. Proud of you for that. Venkman then starts asking questions. So here's Peter Venkman. He's back. And I think, as I mentioned in the beginning, boys, I think Murray seems to be having more fun here than he was in the previous two. I definitely see him rolling with this.
I'm so over Bill Murray just walking into frame and just acting like he doesn't give a shit. That's been everything he's done ever since he hooked up with Wes Anderson. To me, this is no different than when he showed up in Quantumania, where it's like, okay, yeah, the whole... gag is, oh, it's Bill Murray acting like he doesn't give a fuck.
He was in Quantumania?
Oh, God, yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
The movie stops for him to show up.
I haven't seen... Oh, we're going to get to that eventually.
Oh. That is the one I could have done without. Because that part where he pulls out the fucking whiskey that he left there, that was Bill Murray improvising.
Yeah.
As he gets drunk before walking to the next Wes Anderson bullshit garbage movie he's going to make next. Fuck Asteroid City. Fuck anyone who likes that movie.
Oh, boy. All right, we're about ready to hear some real Ritter Roll. Adam, go ahead.
I just added that to my playlist. Asteroid City. I guess I don't need to watch it. I'm not a fan of Bill Murray. I don't like his antics. I don't respect him as a person. I hate his Hollywood-y bullshit way that he goes about projects and things, and even just walking into people's personal lives and shit and being like, ooh, it's okay because I'm Bill Murray. Yeah, it feels like he's like, hey, I'm here. You're going to shoot the day around what I want to do, and I'm going to give you what I want, and then I'm going to walk back to my trailer. That said, I think he's much more game in this film than he has been since the first one. Like, he at least is just like, hey, I got a contract that I wanted this time, so I'm going to, you know, smile my way through it. But I don't know. There's something about Bill Murray that I just really don't like and I can't get over.
Well, there's also, at least in Afterlife, he looked legitimately unsettled that they were resurrecting Harold Ramis. Like, mm-hmm. I don't think he was comfortable with that whatsoever, so there's not that barrier in this movie for him to dance around.
Yeah.
But this plot would function without Venkman. At least the other two, there's a justifiable reason for them to be there. With Venkman, there's really not. Especially since Sigourney Weaver said no to this one.
No, according to her, they didn't even ask her. That's what she said.
Wow.
You know.
I've heard that they didn't ask her or Moranis, which is a shame because we get a nod to, you know, to Tully in this film.
We do. But they're not going to go to him because he's been retired for 20-some-odd years.
Yeah, they should have. But I'll say I'm kind of glad that the marketing at least showed that they all show up and that they're all in, you know, in costume later, because I didn't want to wait and wonder.
Yeah.
Look, I know they're going to be in the film. I know they're going to show up. I know they're going to don the outfit. So at least there wasn't waiting in anticipation to see when it was going to happen, because I knew it was going to happen sooner or later.
Well, that would have had more staying power if they didn't pull that trick in the last movie.
Correct.
Yeah.
Venkman keeps throwing pencils at Nadim, and I found this scene to be actually quite amusing. I thought these two played off each other rather well.
And it took me back to that first one.
Yeah.
Made me chuckle.
Cameo alert. Apparently, the guy who ran the library in the first film is still around, because this is him when they go to the library. The same guy.
Yeah, because they're so desperate to bring everything back, because literally they also bring back the freaking library ghost.
Yes, they do.
Library ghost.
I'm screaming internally for this movie to stop this bullshit.
And I'm liking all of them. That's a weird thing.
Blows my mind, because it's so fucking pandering and childish. Like, it's insulting.
Why are we going to have the same exact discussion during Star Wars? Go ahead, Adam.
It gets to something like a library ghost, and when you see it, and he cocks his head, I'm like, okay, that's enough. You know, and I'm like, that's funny. But then it goes where it basically recreates, you know, the end of the scene completely, and I'm like, oh, Matt's head is exploding. Because it just takes it too far.
I find myself thinking of you fuckers a lot when I watch these movies, by the way. Now, I have no idea how they got Patton Oswalt, one of my favorite comedic actors, by the way, and rendered him about as boring as any character I've ever seen this decade, as he's delivering a ton of exposition using words and animation about this fucking villain that we're going to eventually see. I hated this scene.
Whole freaking Patton Oswalt to deliver a freaking just huge exposition dump. Done with the type of animation we see on the walls of frickin' Themyscira and Wonder Woman. This is a weird pull, and I guess they had to figure out, hey, people are not understanding what's going on.
Probably.
Why are we devoting so much time to the lore when these movies have never been preoccupied with that? It's just, these stories are just here for these characters to riff off of each other, not necessarily to enhance the story. So anytime they devote... That's part of my problem with the second one, too. They spend so much time talking about Vigo.
Yeah.
And all that type of stuff. This one's kind of doing the same thing. And to be honest, I have expected that goddamn painting to show up at some point.
Me too. Especially in a room full of those paintings. I thought for sure he was going to show up.
You know what? I bet it's hidden somewhere in this film and somebody's going to find it on DVD.
Probably.
I doubt it because this movie has the subtlety of a sledgehammer.
Well, Gil Keenan did say, Jason Reitman actually did say, we might find a spot to put Vigo in this one when they were shooting it a couple years ago. So, I don't know, maybe he is here somewhere, but yeah, we never actually get a look at him. We learn of the death chill, which is the power to kill with fear. And then we're hearing more about this Garaka and the Manhattan Adventurers Society.
Yeah, so now we're introducing literal magic and sorcery into the Ghostbusters movie, which also feels like a slap in the face because the whole point of the original movie is that it's using science to combat the supernatural. Here, the supernatural is the more powerful element.
So they make a big deal of like zooming in on the society's name and plaque at the beginning, at the very start of this film. We name drop the society here again. This society has got to matter for what they meant to New York, right? No!
They're the Eternals of mystical organizations, where we pretend that they matter, but in the grand scheme of things, they don't.
We hear a chant that was going on when a ton of New Yorkers froze to death in the middle of July. And these chants made the possessor wake up and grab a trash bag. And then we get a chase that I would classify as rather bizarre, as Ray is, as Matt said, being revisited by the old lady in the library. This fucking chase with this trash bag was really weird.
It's weird, and it's something about, hey, we're going to do a practical, you know, stunt sequence somewhere in this. That had to be the only reason. It ain't bad, but it ain't good.
Yeah.
That's why it feels like such an outlier with the rest of the movie, because it's the one part that's not hamstrung by inconsistent CGI.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's parts of this movie that look really good, and then there's parts of it that look like 2016.
The possessor takes control of the lion on the outside of the library, and from that, and this is from that opening shot of that first Ghostbusters film. And I think the effects with this lion are actually pretty decent. And I remember watching that original movie thinking, ooh, that'd be scary if that lion came to life. Well, here he is, and this was kind of cool to see.
Yeah, I like it. Just, you know, I like the tie-in. I like my, you know, son sitting next to me being like, oh, shit.
Because
the
lion funny.
Started to come to life, you know? So that's more for the kids even than me. So, yeah, and those are the real names of the lions that they're given there at the New York Library. So, yeah, it's New York-y. It fits.
It is what it is.
Alrighty.
I'm already exhausted from all the references.
All right, we're about 2/3 of the way through here. Winston gets on Phoebe's case about shooting up the library as Peck comes to thank her for giving him the power to shut down the Ghostbusters, and then they arrest her. So we got to have the Ghostbusters shut down yet again.
Peck yet again.
Yeah. Phoebe's arrested and then fired. Phoebe questions whether Gruberson is an actual part of the family, and he snaps at her, which causes Callie to like him. We then see Winston tell Ray to go on vacation because this is supposed to be their golden years, and he needs to find a new way to do the things he loves before it kills him. This is a plot they introduce, and they do nothing with it.
Yeah, if you were going to have them be this integral to the story, this should have been much more at the forefront.
Mm-hmm. They were actually more at the forefront than I was expecting. Honestly, like they play more in than I originally thought when I heard this movie was coming out. But
yeah, I mean, this plays like Ghostbusters 2.5.
Yeah, good call. We cut to Callie and company coming home with Elmer Bernstein's score playing in the background, and Nadim, he's in the firehouse wanting to use the pole, much like Ray did in that first film. We then see Callie and Gruberson. They talk about fighting for the firehouse as Rudd sings the song to make his point. Oh, this made me groan. I'm not like you guys.
Find a way to squeeze that thing.
Yeah, I'm not like you guys. Like, I didn't really, I wasn't that against Rudd in this movie. I thought he played an okay background character. But when he does this shit, I'm like, oh God, this is fucking so groan-inducing. But of course, he's singing this song, which probably is the reason why Ray Parker had all that money to freaking gamble when he came to the Atlantis a few months ago. We hear that Nadim's destiny is to be a fire master. And I love how enthusiastically Aykroyd is giving this exposition. But this is pure, real Ghostbuster shit. This is shit that just wouldn't work in a movie.
It doesn't fit Ghostbusters.
No.
It doesn't fit the science part of it. It doesn't... You know, look, I can enjoy the jokes when they go back to his apartment, you know, and all that stuff there. That shit makes me laugh. The whole, you know, grandma sex dungeon. You know, that kind of joke makes me think of the dirty humor in the original. But this just, I don't know, he doesn't fit. He sticks out. And it's not the ethnicity. It's not the, like, I like tying back into the Sumerian part of it because that's Gozer. That's, you know, I'm down with that. But it's just, don't know, it feels like an afterthought, maybe just shoved in later to try to tie it together. Nanjiani just...
That's what this movie should have been called, Gus Wester's Afterthought.
Yeah, and Matt made this point earlier, which is a really good one, is that the series has always been about, you know, bringing in supernatural elements into a zany comedy. Now they're bringing in sorcery. That makes it just too weird.
Well, it's also sorcery supplanting science, which is the direct antithesis of the first movie. So now they're in, like, this weird, like, paradoxical component.
And as much as it's a comedy, it's never a farce where you lose, you know, some of the serious elements and some of those type of tones with it. Where you start to slip into farce territory, you might as well be an SNL skit.
Yeah, well, because the thing is, in the previous movies, even 2016, the supernatural is always treated with a serious, like, borderline threatening component where it's an actual threat. Here it's an afterthought.
So Nadim is told to light the candle, which is sitting a few inches from the lighter, and Nadim just can't do it. I wonder if he'll be able to do it by the end of the film.
Like, Adam, when did this become an X-Men movie?
That's exactly what I thought of, too, and that's why I look at this, and I'm like, this is stupid. This isn't fucking Ghostbusters. Maybe from the cartoon, but that's it.
I'm like, guys, you're in the wrong part of New York. Xavier's school is a couple down the street.
Up in Westminster, yeah, he's the firebender.
We cut to Phoebe walking the streets with Melody, giving poor me speeches, feeling happy that she has a friend and a ghost to talk to. Oh my god. It's so sad what they've done to this character. She then says that there's a way for her to become a ghost for a few minutes, and this intrigues Melody.
I see in no way how this could be malicious, so I'm going to go along with this, no questions asked, because I'm a dumb teenager.
Oh my god.
This machine that we get, which, I mean, to me,
this is the machine from Casper. It's literally the same machine.
It's Casper and the Fly put together is what it is.
I mean, this whole thing is like Dan Aykroyd loving possession. You know, I mean, this is Needful Things where everything is possessed by a spirit. And so we got this machine and we're going to rip a spirit out of all these items. At what point in this movie did they ever say that it can separate a soul from the body until Callie discusses it here?
And that's what's so stupid about it. There is no introduction to this whatsoever in anything. They just came with up the story out of their ass. Now, there's a possibility, and Camille has talked about this, as has Gil Keenan, that they wanted to make this feel more like an episode of the real Ghostbusters cartoon. There's a possibility stuff like this was done in that cartoon. But as far as the movie universe goes, no.
It does feel like a live-action version of the... To that point, it's enjoyable if you look at it like the real Ghostbusters.
Mm-hmm. I can't look at it that way because that works really well in a 30-minute window.
Exactly.
This cannot keep that level of zaniness for 2 hours because everything else is so razor thin. And also, it's not funny, which the TV show actually is in a genuine sense.
So Phoebe wakes up a ghost. She approaches the apparition who says that she's sorry, as Gareka needs to use her voice to open the door so Melody can see her family again. And she concludes that maybe one day you'll understand.
Okay, so he cannot control a person, but he can control her spirit.
Correct.
And by possessing her spirit, that controls the person. You have a possessor spirit that was already there, but the possessor spirit can only possess a thing?
Yeah, it can only possess inanimate objects, apparently.
What's frustrating, like, say, when I break this movie down, I have issues with steps all along the way. When I'm watching it, I'm like, hey, I enjoy this, but I'm struck every time by, how did somebody not ask a question that could have been written better in the script? How did somebody not say, hey, instead of A, let's do B, it's going to work better? Because this entire film is laid out with, if you make this choice, it's better. If you make this choice, it's better. It's like they never rewrote this film to make it sharper.
We then finally see the villain, supposedly inspired by a ton of villains from the original cartoon. How do we feel about old Gareka? You know, to me, he's okay. I think he's formidable. I think he's imposing. He's about as imposing as Gozer was in that original film. And that villain did indeed scare me as a kid, but I'm not sure this would have done the same, because with the exception of a deep voice and scary eyes, there's really nothing scary about him.
Oh, this is your season one Buffy villain of the week.
Yeah, I thought of Buffy too.
Yeah, it's a big CGI creature with horns. Like, other than the claws... You know, when you don't see the entire thing, when all you see is that hand reaching for someone, yeah, you got a good scary element there. but I'm bothered by what we do here. So we were told, and we're told this, I think, three times, that he kills people through fear.
Yes.
So what that means is, much like Green Lantern, somebody has to overcome their fear to beat this guy, right? That's not what's going on here. If he's only killing through fear by making people afraid and the death chill that's free, those are words on a page, and that's not what's happening here. He just comes in like pissed off Elsa.
We see that the orb has been shattered, meaning that Garaka is out there as Garaka comes to a shop looking for the Fire Master, a lot like Dana asked for the Key Master in that first film.
Every time you say Garaka, I think you're saying Baraka, like Mortal Kombat.
Every time I tried typing it, it said Barak. But he ends up icing that guy to Kona phrase, right, Matt?
If I could pay $5 to have him dubbed with Arnold Schwarzenegger, Mr. Freeze lines, I would gladly do so.
That's actually a Last Action Hero. Oh, no, that is a Mr. Freeze line. You're right. Never mind.
No, but that line you said was Last Action
yeah,
Hero.
That was, yeah. And finally, what we were promised in that trailer happens as New York is frozen over. It takes over a beach, because why not? And then we see Camille, he's able to finally light this candle as the Ghostbusters get equipped with new proton packs. Is this a Winston thing? Were we ever told that there were going to be new proton packs?
No, this is the Joel Schumacher Batman route of, we need a new toy to sell, so come up with a new with a new gadget for the third act.
I fucking hate this. Like, this is all so fucking convenient. So Phoebe comes up with the idea of using psychically charged brass inside their packs.
Yeah, where did this brass platform
Where did this come from?
Nanjiani's grandmother's sex dungeon. The room was coated in brass because it, like, closed off Baracus.
Oh, that's right. They did mention that in passing.
They set it up. Mm. Yep.
And that's one justification, but there's still, like, 30... Like, this movie should be called Unsolved Mysteries.
But what's inexcusable, and I had two kids on both sides of me go, if she cut down the fire pole, why do they keep sliding down the fire pole? She cuts it up.
Yes.
She melts it, and she only dips the parts of one proton pack, because I guess I do all four when one is going to do the job. But the fire pole never disappears.
That's a great point.
Isn't the fire pole made out of brass, too?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's why she melted it, and that's what Adam's saying, is that it's a editing faux pas. Yet another one, in that they slide down the pole after she cuts it up. Wonderful catch by your kids. Winston is past his whole let the others do the work as he approaches Ray and says, let's get to work. Venkman makes his appearance while drinking liquid courage, and he compliments Janine on getting in uniform. A tricycle rolls down the street, Nightmare 3 style. That's what I thought of.
I did like that part of it.
Yeah, I did too.
Because that felt just like a horror movie, you know. Call.
You know what else I like? And this is probably my favorite bit in this entire movie. And it happens amongst all this chaos that's going on with the city freezing and whatnot. For a few seconds, the headlights of Echo One turn red, and it looks like they're going to go full on Christine with it.
I thought of you a lot when that happened.
God, it was awesome. But then it just fucking disappears and stops.
Yep. The car's possessed, and then the possessor leaves it.
God, why did the fucking possessor just stay in there?
That possessor shows up when it needs to, and then just fucks off when it doesn't.
Yeah.
His Uber ran out.
The little yellow ghost, he spits slime as paper flies and the proton pack points at Trevor. But this doesn't happen as, wouldn't you know it, Camille has learned this fire trick pretty quickly and guides the beam away.
As he can move the photon beam?
Same as fire?
Because those beams are fire? The fire, I'm rolling my eyes, I'm like, fucking whatever. This pissed me off.
Yeah.
You can bend fire, that's a fucking photon stream.
That's like trying to justify someone being able to control Cyclops' optic blast by claiming it's heat-based.
Exactly. Here's Slimer. He's making his way back into the story, eating as always. Phoebe confronts Melody and points her proton pack at her. Phoebe says there's still time to stop this from happening as Garaka puts on his horns, and he's being tall, dark, and horny, as Venkman calls him, and he announces that he's here. The Ghostbusters
should have been here 90 minutes earlier.
You're not kidding. Way too late. The Ghostbusters approach, and of course their streams are useless. We then see Camille, he's finally getting to use that pole, and then asks Garaka to go back to Narnia while he goes back to Queens. That was the only time Camille made me laugh this entire movie, was that line. He asks Camille if he's the Fire Master. Of course he says no, so they get all locked up in ice, and Garaka mumbles some things, and Melody tells Phoebe goodbye, and wouldn't you know it? Here we go, Matt. Sky portal time.
I almost threw my hands up and walked out.
I almost text you when that happened. We get a montage of Phoebe looking into the energy portal. She loads up her brass proton pack and she fires away. The beast growls a bit and we hear the same sound effect they used when originally killing the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, by the way. You just hear bloom. We cut to Mill. He's letting loose with some fire because now he can control it. As Callie and Gooberson, they hold the flame steady and the drone trap arrives to trap him. But Venkman utters the phrase that I was thinking too. You're going to need a bigger trap. I'll say, you know, I have a lot of bad things to say about this movie, obviously, but I do like some of the original gang's repartee. For example, when Ray says, do you know what we have to do? Venkman's like, Ray, pretend that I don't. And then when Ray starts explaining, Venkman goes, just do it. We all trust you. Me and Jen both laughed out loud at that. I liked when they were both going at it here. Matt, did you get any enjoyment here?
Yes, but it was also sad because I feel like it was undermining the original or the Afterlife cast.
I don't think that was undermining them. They're just doing the same things. I had no issues with this whatsoever. It's continuity to me because they've been doing this since 1984. They open the containment system as Ray and Winston utter golden years at one another. Another thing we're going to be reviewing soon, boys, in the next couple years is Golden Years from Stephen King. As the light is green, which means that the world is clean. Phoebe says goodbye to Casper. As she says that she'll see her in the fabric of the universe as she disappears. Phoebe then hugs her mom. As New York melts away, the line is back on its perch, and the Ghostbusters take in the crowd ovations. Mayor Peck shows back up, saying that he's going to put them all away, as reporters come to interview him, and Winston says that they're there to answer the call because they are the Ghostbusters.
This also has the worst callback in the entire movie, and that's saying a lot. Some guy in the crowd yells, Dickless.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. If anything, it should have come from Venkman. Just be like, hey, Dickless.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or, actually, it was Aykroyd who uttered it in the first one. We get a final montage and a title that says, For Ivan, in tribute to Ivan Reitman, who, as I mentioned earlier, he passed away in February 2022. You know what, guys? You were able to manipulate a tear out of me the last time because you had a movie with heart and spoke to me in a lot of ways. But you cannot manipulate me this week.
Really?
Yeah.
For Ivan?
Mm-hmm. Because it's manipulating the same way they did when they set For Harold last time. Do it at the end of the credits. Don't do it in the beginning of the credits. But you know what? This isn't the end of the movie, boys. We get one extra scene. Did you guys see this scene?
What?
Yeah. Because we're...
No.
there's a mid-credit scene.
Yep.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
You know what? They did a terrible job of promoting this film, but at the end of this, in this final scene here, they do a pretty good job of promoting a remake of Maximum Overdrive because... We see a guy's truck being taken control of by the little Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, and that's how it ends. Yes, credits roll on Ghostbusters Frozen something something something. All right.
But for the first time in forever, I'm glad I didn't stick around for that bullshit.
All right. Scale of 1 to 10. What do we have to say about Ghostbusters Frozen Empire? I'm going to let Matt's red eyes kind of cool down a bit. Adam, you go ahead and go, sir.
We have beat this film up pretty good, and for pretty good reason. Watching this film in the venue that I had with my family around me, I didn't have nearly the vitriol as we're watching it. This movie does not hold a candle. Sorry, Nanjiani.
Nice.
Does not hold the lit candle to the original, but it is not as offensive to me as something like Ghostbusters 2 or even 2016. It's a continuation of Afterlife, and I liked Afterlife quite a bit. The issue with this film is it's too long, it's edited poorly, the screenplay itself suffers from inconsistencies, poor ideas, and ideas where it looks like they may have even combined different drafts and didn't clean up the things that would have made it smooth. Introducing new characters while keeping all the old ones still in place, it just makes this thing so bloated, even more than Slimer in that attic. I mean, Finn Wolfhard is in and out of this film for no reason, as we've mentioned over and over there, other than he's on contract. Oddcast and Lucky and so many other people are here just because they were in the last one. They don't have a role, and that's a shame. And we didn't even mention, but I love seeing Annie Potts back. That's the type of thing that made me happy. I love seeing her in the Ghostbusters get up and her moments with Bill Murray, those ones I did like. Like, I felt like that was a sweet little moment, and that made me kind of get that real Ghostbusters feel more than anything else. I can't say this movie is horrible. I can't say this movie is good. It is a decent sequel to Ghostbusters Afterlife. I think if you like that film, I think you'll like this one enough, but lower your expectations. There's a lot of family drama. There's a lot of teen drama. And having a teenage daughter who looks and acts like Phoebe does in this, that's sweet when she's sitting to my right-hand side in a movie theater. Watching it by myself, I'd be a lot less forgiving to this movie. It's not horrible. It's not good. This movie could have had so many better things going about it. We've mentioned, though, that the marketing, guess what? Everything you see in that marketing, you fucking wait around an hour and a half before it starts to show up, because that's when it does. I don't know if you could make a third one to this other than they probably will just to do it. I'm going to give this a 6, though. It's not bad. It ain't great, but it's a passable Ghostbusters film. I just wish it would have had a little more of the magic that I liked in Afterlife, or some of that dark horror comedy that the first one got.
All right, so we have a 6, which is a higher score than I was expecting. All right, Matt, maybe for the last time, why don't you go ahead and let your bitter roll out about Ghostbusters?
My opinion still stands that there has not been a good Ghostbusters movie since 1984. This reminded me a lot of the last Jurassic World movie that came out, where they brought back Sam Neill and Jeff Goldblum. They brought everybody back, and they were good. But then the movie remembers that there's other characters they've established, so it feels like this weird hodgepodge where you don't please anybody. And I don't see how this would satisfy big Ghostbusters fans outside of the stuff that is directly referencing the first movie. And I'm exhausted by member berries as it is, so I was sort of exacerbated as this movie was starting, let alone the 2 hours when it was done. I think this movie's a bloated mess, and I don't know how I can praise it with a lot of positivity, because the stuff that I liked in the first one, Afterlife, namely your main character, I've completely turned on because of what they ask her to do throughout this movie. And all the other returning characters just feel like they're here because they were signed on for a second movie. And it's all the more damning that the Ghostbusters original cast, Bill Murray notwithstanding, came to play, and it kind of made me wish that, on some degree, they were the focal point instead of this weird tug-of-war going back and forth. It's no worse or better than any of the other dumb blockbusters we've gotten over the last decade with these properties. I don't feel like there's anything new to offer. I don't feel like there's anything with this premise that was really brought to its fullest potential. And it left me just wanting more, so I'm going to land on a 4/10.
4/10 from Matt Gaudreau. You know, I mentioned RoboCop when we started this, and that was a franchise I thought of when I was watching this, mostly because like they've been chasing that first one for so many years now, and they haven't caught up to it. I think the last film, despite what Matt says, I think the last one came close to at least making me feel good about these characters again, better than I did in the second film. But this one takes everything positive that they did in that first one and just turns it on its head. And sometimes that can be a good thing. In this case, it's not. I think the main problem with this movie, too many fucking characters. And it is all over the place. There is not one set of structure at all with this film. I understand they wanted to, as the old adage is, we introduced everybody in that first one, so let's just have fun with this one. I get it, but nothing about this. And Jen said it right as we were leaving the theater. She was like, that first one had heart. This one didn't really have that much heart. We get some teen love angst. They do a half-assed freaking stepfather plot, and that's it. And another thing is, I watched this movie, and I'm just like, you took McKenna Grace, and you turned her into this lovesick teenager. And I get that this is what teenagers go through. I'm sure somebody on this podcast has a teenager who is going to go through it at one point. And I get that, you know, they're trying to talk to them. And I'm happy that it talked to Maddie, but this didn't talk to me. And, you know, I like the rapport between the original Ghostbusters. I think Dan Aykroyd's having a blast. I think Ernie Hudson's just happy to be around catering. And Bill Murray, well, I don't know if he's been happy in about 30 years, but he's here and he looks like he's having fun. This movie needed an editor and it needed just some structure. I have the same exact score written down as Matt. I have 4. I don't want to see any more of this. You know, I'm not quite as harsh on this as I was on Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. That movie broke my heart. This movie just made me look and say, no more. And in that way, it was similar to Dial of Destiny 2, where I just looked and I'm just like, no more. We have seen these characters come back. It was nice to see them come back. It was really fun to see them last film. Here, they got to do their thing once again, but let's be done with it. No more. The movie has made back its budget and more, so there's a possibility we could get more, but I'm done. Matt, I assume you are too.
I've been done since 1984 and I wasn't even alive.
Adam, do you think there's any chance that they could do a better movie with this than a 6 out of 10 for you?
Do I think they could? Yes. Do I think they will? I think they'll make it. I don't think it'll be better than this. I think it'll be the low point of this trilogy.
And more, but after starting off with such a wonderful career with Up in the Air and certain other projects that Thank You for Smoking, that I was really, really happy that Jason Reitman was around making movies. And he's had things where he's directed stuff by Diablo Cody that I've liked. But, you know, he's the son of a really well-renowned person in the business. He's looking more and more like Duncan Jones than he is his father, Ivan Reitman. I just want to see Jason Reitman do something that's good again. And this wasn't good. It was bad. Bad, bad, bad.
He didn't direct this. I can only give him so much blame.
He didn't direct it, but he was a huge part of it. He was on set almost every day. He wrote it. He was a part of the visualization of it. So he is a big part to blame, to me. Speaking of bad, 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 next week we go back to the Mangler, or back to King once again. It's been a rough first quarter of the year.
Lock me back up in that orb.
It's been a rough first part of the year for my two colleagues. But then after that, we're going to go back to Apes, finish that out. And then there's a series that, well, Matt's been wanting to do, and I'm going to hold off on revealing that until we get to it. But I'm really excited to do that series. Here's a hint. It has a movie coming out this year. So there's something to tide you over. But until next week, we get to The Mangler Reborn. Oh, my God. Podcast. Love them or kill them. Thank you, guys.
Are you sure this is safe?
Safe? No. No. History is safe. Geometry, that's safe. Science is all particle accelerators and hydrogen bombs. Science is giving yourself the plague and gambling on the cure.
Science is reckless.
Totally, yes.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Three Men and a Retrospective podcast, exclusively on Percolated Media.
Two in the box!
Ready to go!
We be fast and
they be slow!
Join us next week for an entirely new review. And if you want to hear how the boys feel about the rest of the films in the Ghostbusters franchise, head on over to BingeMedia.net and click the Aftertaste tab.
I mean, the architect was either a certified genius or an authentic wacko.
Did you choose anything?
No!
Did you?
The line is totally blank.
I didn't choose anything!
And if you enjoyed this review, please head on over to percolatedmedia.net or search your podcast platform of choice to access our Percolated Media archives and hear our reviews of other franchises like Star Wars, Indiana Jones, Pirates of the Caribbean, Top Gun, the Planet of the Apes film series, the Incredibles movies, and so many more.
You only have 75 more to go.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
You know, my dad said you guys are full of crap.
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
Personally, Lenny, I think it's a sign from God, but don't quote me on that.
These men are consummate snowball artists.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
This is podcast. He's my friend.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
Since I joined these men, I have seen shit that'll turn you white.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
We've been going about this all wrong. This Mr. Stay Puft is okay. He's a sailor. He's in New York. We get this guy laid, we won't have any trouble.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is for review and discussion, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
Sometimes shit happens, someone has to deal with it, and who are you going to call?
Bye.
I'll fix you, Venkman. I'm going to fix you.
I'm going to get you a nice fruit basket. I'm going to miss him. All right.
An animated Ghostbusters cartoon. Animated cartoon. Way to go. Nice redundancy. animated Ghostbusters film.
As it would have been different if it was John Belushi instead of Bill
Murray. Yes.
Who was the one person, by the way, who I am shocked he came back for that.
You know what, though? According to Kanan, like, and even... Grace McKenna? I can't remember. Which one's her first name? McKenna Grace, right?
McKenna Grace.
Yeah, McKenna Grace said that he was...
It's also a lot harder to... I think it's also harder to replicate comedies.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, that's a big part, like, of it, too.
How many great comedy sequels are there? You got Hot Shots Part 2. And maybe like five others.
So I remember really laughing at Naked Gun 2.5, but... We start off. What's that?
All those Naked Gun movies blend together.
Yeah, you're not kidding. We start off with the Sony and Columbia logos.
Of the five movies, this one, even more so than 2016, feels the most disjointed, and that's saying a lot.
Matt or Adam? Adam, are you there, sir?
He got stuck in his own containment pod.
is he there?
It says he's on the call.
Yeah, he's on the call, so maybe he had to leave the room or something. All right. I'm just going to move on. Meanwhile, Phoebe and Podcast show up at a diner, and the ghost they've been ordered to bust is actually the one Phoebe was talking to earlier. I have to say right now, this plot is... Oh, he did leave. Fuck. All right. Let's see if we can...
You should be able to just add him back.
Yeah, there he is.
Steve?
Yeah, you're here. You all right?
Like, I was talking, I wasn't muted, so I don't know why suddenly it cut out.
Ah, okay.
You got me now?
Yes. Okay. All right, let's talk to you then. How do you feel about the pacing of this, Adam?
Pacing, I think, is a little all over the place.
But until next week, we get to the Mangler Reborn. Oh, my God. Podcast. Love them or kill them. Thank you, guys. All right.
What? Damn it. Sorry, I was going to... This podcast has no dick.
Again, wait till after we hit stop before you utter something. It's always a pain in the ass because I think, oh, good, I'm done editing. Oh, wait, no, Adam has a blooper. God damn it.
Fucking Adam.
Do. Ray.
Egon.